Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast. Set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Benoit Bennett is here. He's a graffiti artist talking about a print about Westmoreland House on Stokes Croft. And they're starting a land trust as the best way to guarantee places for people to live. And then we move to a special on Greenham. Fran D'Arth lives here in Bristol, and she was one of the people who started the protest camp at Greenham Common against US nuclear cruise missiles in the 1980s. And also another Fran, she was also at Greenham. We get her take too. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk.
I'm Benoit Bennett. I'm a director of the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, and I'm also an artist who does street art as well as lots of other stuff.
Hey, you're one of those people that's graffitiing everywhere, tagging everywhere, are you?
No, I don't go out tagging. I generally do things that are more on the street art end of graffiti and street art.
So tagging is really just kind of putting your name on something, and actually people quite often will put their name on someone else's piece of art if they don't like it. Is that,
sometimes if it's placed respectfully, it's a sign of support of the artist who painted it as well. So it's more subtle than most people give it credit for.
Now, I mean, if you go back 20, 30 years in Britain, there was hardly any graffiti. It's something that was really thought of as a third world thing. Why has it been such a massive increase, do you think?
I think it appeals to certain people as something that is intrinsically a rebellious act a lot of the time. There's a whole class of graffiti artists who won't paint legal spaces despite if they're there or not. And some of them are even like well-known people as well.
I mean, there is actually quite a lot going on in the city generally with graffiti artists from around the world coming to Bristol.
Yeah, there's a lot of international artists come to Bristol, but the amount of homegrown talent isn't there. Like, there are people who are quite successful, but most of the people coming up through it at the moment are not doing so well, I think. Like, a lot of people who grew up in Bristol doing graffiti have left because it's not something, if you're serious about the art, then it's not something that's easily well supported in Bristol.
And can you, well, that's interesting because I thought they had an annual festival of graffiti of some sort here.
Yeah, they do. But in conversations I've had with the organisers, I think they're shocked that they don't get more support from the council.
Oh, I see, right. What about making money doing graffiti? Is it feasible? I mean, you know, obviously you want to express yourself by whatever means. Some people do that through photography. Some people put art in, you know, sell it for people to put on their walls. Is it feasible to make a living doing graffiti?
It's feasible. I think you have to have a very business head on your shoulders. In the same way as most artists, if you want to make a success of doing art, you have to approach it more of a business and less as a expressive thing.
And are there any themes that you think run through in Bristol, here in Bristol, through the art that graffiti artists are putting out?
I think the graffiti and even a lot of the tags in Bristol are more political than you get other places, but I wouldn't say that. I think there's a big split. Well, there are lots of little splits, but there's a big split between people who are into lettering and proper graffiti and people who have got into street art because it's another thing to add to the types of art they can do. So there's a lot of people who are kind of illustrators who then go out and make big pieces on the street.
What is it that, I mean, you do this yourself, so you can tell me, what is it inside you that you manage to get rid of once you've finished a piece of art out on the street?
I think it's a shortcut to getting your work seen for me a lot of the time. I don't push my own work very much, and if I just paste a piece onto a wall or paint a piece directly onto a wall, then it will definitely get seen, whereas if I do it at home, then it may languish in a shed or something.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's absolutely out there and in your face, isn't it? What about your... Just give us an example of the sort of stuff you do. One of your last pieces, what was that about? And what was the kind of context? Difficult to do on the radio, graffiti, obviously, because we want to be looking at it, really.
Yeah,
if you could
sure.
just describe it.
And the last pieces I did that were for myself, as opposed to kind of more commissioned pieces, was Down in the Bear Pit. And it was specifically about what's happening down in the bear pit. And so it was quite abstract. It had some characters in it. They had speech bubbles, which kind of is where I put my point across.
This sounds to me, it's almost like you are doing something which is a little bit like a political cartoon, the sort of thing you might see in the newspaper.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it feels a bit like that sometimes. Like, other times it is more expressive and just a big doodle.
And how long does it take for you to be walking past and find that somebody has painted over it and it's gone completely?
Sometimes it's 2 minutes. Literally, I've come past and someone's put a fly poster over what I've done and it's ruined. And other times I've got pieces that I did 10 years ago and are still there. So if the placement is right, then it's...
I suppose the best thing to do is to get up a really rickety ladder into a big building that's derelict for a long time and no one's ever likely to clean for the next 10 years. I mean, have you ever done, been doing a bit of graffiti art in a place you thought, actually, this is a bit dangerous, I should be maybe strapped on with some climbing ropes or something?
Yeah, the closest to that was up the top of a 3-piece scaffold, though, so it was like an official thing, but it was definitely pretty sketchy, like 3 stories up on a scaffolding that moves if you stand at the other end.
So isn't what you're doing criminal damage?
I'm pretty sure everywhere that I paint is legal or tacitly legal. There's a lot of places in Bristol where it's kind of a grey area, but it's been accepted for so long that it's not usually prosecuted. So.
Now, one of the places we've seen a lot of graffiti over the years is at Westmoreland House on Stokes Croft. And I know you're part of the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. I've seen a lot of scaffolding going up there. Actually, even single alternate line traffic lights slowing the traffic down up and down Stokes Croft over the last few weeks. So what is happening there and why is PRSC getting involved?
So the building... Westmoreland House itself is being torn down. They said they'd have made a start already. So the first pieces should be coming off the back where people can't see at the moment. And the whole of the site there, so that building, the carriage works next to it, and where the travellers lived before, behind the building, are all being redeveloped.
So hang on a minute. The carriage works is actually quite architecturally beautiful. Is that all coming down?
The front wall is staying.
Oh, okay. So everything but the front wall.
And
okay.
There were fires there and all sorts, which are kind of, people say, a suspect and were part of attempts to get rid of a grade listed building because it was awkward for developing the site. But as far as I understand, they're keeping the position of the back wall, but actually rebuilding it, and the front will stay. And they're restoring that. So... with the building coming down and it being such a Westmoreland House, the modern brutalist section of it being destroyed, it's been an iconic building for Stokes Croft for a long time, especially since it got the burning candy pieces on the top, the skull and the crocodile, which you can see for miles away. And the PRSC's involvement, we've been involved in the campaign for trying to get a decent development there for a long time. And... now...
well, hang on, because you're saying a decent development. What do you mean by that? I mean, surely whoever owns the land is just going to put whatever they want there. You don't really get much of a say in that, surely.
The land is owned by some people who have owned property all over the country and have land banked it.
So they're speculators, really, yeah.
Yeah, it's been empty since the mid-80s. They've been resisting the council compulsory purchasing the site, and that is essentially, as I think, as far as I understand, the reason that the latest round of planning permission went in.
I can remember it. George Ferguson was mayor. He was talking about compulsory purchasing it. And then they said, oh, it's okay, we're going to be developing it. And so he backed off from compulsory purchasing and they didn't do anything.
Yeah, and then nothing happened. And then the council said they were going to compulsory purchase the site again. And when it looked like it was actually going to happen, then if you put in a planning application, then compulsory purchases automatically are cancelled. So they did that. Those developers are no longer doing it. Someone else has taken over, but it's the same. It's a plan that has actually been extensively modified and is not as bad as it was due to the pressure that has been put on by different campaigning groups and people.
So what's it going to look like eventually, do you think? I mean, is it going to be shops, sort of arcades or anything that you can walk into?
Yeah, so as a result of the pressure put on the developers, it's no longer have gates on it. There'll be an internal courtyard, which they've said will have markets in it. there'll be commercial and community spaces on the ground floor, which were only going to be street facing and now we're going to be ringing the courtyard inside. And there were going to be, I think it was just like one or two affordable, so-called affordable apartments in there. And now there's going to be maybe a couple more, and there's still not many.
Okay, so we've managed to squeeze a little bit more out of these greedy developers. But anyway, so what about this artwork you've done for it?
As a symbol of the rebellious spirit of Stokes Croft, the building is quite well known. And as it's coming down, we've launched a screen print as a memorial to the building. And we're using it to help fund the setting up of a Stokes Croft Land Trust, which is the only feasible way that we can see to actually resist gentrification in the long term. So of the print costs £50, and of that, £40 will go into developing the Stokes Croft Land Trust as a vehicle for owning different properties around Stokes Croft.
So what is a land trust?
It's a way of buying property as a community. You issue shares of a property and different people can buy into it, and then it is held in perpetuity by the board of directors, essentially, who have to then use it for community benefit.
Okay, so they don't specifically actually own the land, but they manage the land for the community.
It's owned by all the hopefully hundreds of people who buy into the land.
Well, hang on, that sounds like what the council should be doing.
Yeah, for sure. I think the council should be looking after community buildings and helping people secure community assets, but it doesn't seem to happen very
much. So how do people get hold of this print if they want one in their living room or their bedroom or their toilet?
Yeah, wherever you'd like to put it. They'll be available online from stokescroftlandtrust.org. There's a link on there, or you can come into the Stokes Croft China shop on Jamaica Street, and we've got them in there, and there's framed ones in there as well, which if you'd like it to look a bit smarter.
And it's got that giant skull on the top, hasn't it, which has been there for years. So is this your own bit of work you've done?
Yeah, I did the drawing, and then another artist who works in our building actually made the screen print in our new screen printing studio downstairs. It's the first official piece that's come out of there.
Okay, so you do screen printing in Stokes Croft too. That's a bit old-fashioned, isn't it? I thought most people just sort of churn stuff and graphic design it on a computer and it all comes out on a very much more modern thing. What is screen printing?
Screen printing is putting an image onto a mesh screen, and then you push the ink through. It's like a big stencil, essentially, but the pieces don't have to have the gaps in that you have in a stencil, and it can be very detailed. But it's a more analog way of doing things, and you can do it without relying on technology and without having to buy
some expensive machine to do the printing for you. Yeah, okay, manual printing. Okay, and so how many of these are you making? 500, is it?
Yeah, the edition is limited to 500, and they all come signed and numbered with a little foil embossed stamp on the bottom.
Finally, tell us a bit about the sort of what goes on in realms of arts at PRSC.
So the People's Republic of Stokes Croft does a range of different things. From I repainted Turbo Island today. We maintain a bunch of the street art around here, like the wave on Hillgrove Street would be pretty much obliterated by now if we hadn't got rid of the tags on that all the time. We have artist studios upstairs, so there's a bunch of different kinds of artists, from ceramic artists to street artists who use that space. And we've got our own ceramic studio where we hand decorate all the china that is in the Stokes Croft China shop.
And you're doing screen printing too, fantastic.
And now we're doing screen printing too. The print will be available from stokescroftlandtrust.org. There's a link directly from there to where you can buy it online.
Okay, Benoit Bennett, thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure, thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Fran Diaf. I was one of the people that first set up the camp at Greenham Common where the American cruise missiles were going to be sighted.
Now, for people that don't know, these were mobile nuclear ballistic missiles that could be fired from anywhere, and they were going to be based at this, what is it, an RAF base?
Yeah, technically an RAF base. And my main beef, actually, was that we had no control over them. These were American nuclear weapons. So if America had made any trouble anywhere in the world, we were the target, not America.
Perish the thought. They've been making trouble ever since.
He does rather seem that way, doesn't it?
Okay, so why did you pick on Greenham?
Well,
because there were several bases, I think, they were using, weren't there?
Well, I don't know about how many other places actually had the American nuclear missiles. It was because Ann Pettit and Carmen Cutler over in Wales, they were waiting for a protest to start about this sighting, the intended sighting of these missiles, and it didn't happen. So they thought, right, well, we'd best do it ourselves. And they organised a walk from Cardiff all the way to Greenham in Berkshire near Newbury. And when they got there, there wasn't much press coverage, and they thought, crikey, you know, we've walked all this way. It was a big achievement. Most of them were mums, and, you know, it was a big deal doing that. And so a couple of them chained themselves to the fence, and that got some media coverage. Most of the people had to go home, and a couple stayed on. And then about a week later, I heard about it from a man friend. I must say that Greenham's famous for being a women's project, but it didn't start off as a women's project. It started off as Women's Initiative, and there were men on the walk. But if ever there was any public speaking or anything like that, it was for the women to speak and not the blokes.
So was there a problem there then between men and women? Why was it decided to make it a women's thing?
Right, well, we went women. So I arrived about a week after they'd been there, and so there were about six of us. No money, and setting up the camp. And a couple of men, and then it, you know, grew to maybe about 12. And then we started planning on doing a blockade around the whole base. And there'd been an incident. Now, bear in mind, everybody's got their own Greenham story, right? So anybody listening to this might say, that's not what happened. But this is my version of what I experienced. One day, a digger came up heading towards the camp, which was, we just had one camp outside the main gate.
So is that a RAF digger or an American one?
This was an English ordinary bloke, right, and civilian. And so me and a couple of other people sat down in front of the digger, and a couple of the fellas didn't sit down. Some of the fellas did, but a couple didn't. And I went over to, you know, stood up, went over to the blokes that were standing and saying, look, sit down, because the chap in the digger doesn't know what your intention is. He doesn't know that you're not going to go and whack him, right? There wasn't a cab to this digger. He was quite exposed, the driver. And he doesn't know your intention, so just sit down, and then everybody knows we're non-violent. But they wouldn't. So that got us to thinking that we were planning our very first blockade. We were very frightened about what was going to happen to us, if the police were going to be rough with us. None of us had ever done anything like that before, and we didn't have any role models. And so we had a big meeting about how to cope with these particular blokes. Now, those particular ones, they were nice blokes. I got on fine with them, and I used to do some stuff with them down in Newbury. But they lived in a teepee. And anyway, so that's part of the story in a minute. So we had this meeting where it was just the women meeting, and we decided that on the run-up to our first blockade, we would make it women only. It was quite a momentous decision, which meant, of course, we threw the baby out with the bathwater as well. So the decent blokes. They were all decent blokes, actually, but the ones that were more in tune with us had to go as well, which they found rather upsetting. And it was... I've subsequently went off and studied conflict resolution in Canada and learned about analysing your problem before you make any decisions. And, of course, what happened is we didn't analyse our problem sufficiently. And what happened then is, so they all went, and those particular chaps in the teepee went off. Another peace camp had started up and they went there. And they made the same mistake. They made a rule, because that was our first rule at Greenham, no men. They made a rule of no teepees as a way of getting rid of those particular chaps. And so I eventually came to the conclusion that really nuclear weapons weren't the real issue, that what the real issue in life is how we manage conflict. And that's why I went to Canada and studied for a year conflict resolution.
Now, how long were you at Greenham Common then?
I was there for the first 7 months, all through the first winter.
I mean, did you ever find that the authorities used dirty tricks, tactics or anything like that to get rid of you?
When I was there...
I mean, I'm not sure who sent the digger, but it doesn't sound like a friendly gesture.
No, I mean, of course, they weren't particularly friendly, but... we learned that our ethos was our argument was not with the police, our argument was not with the military, our argument was with the government. And that made a big difference on how we conducted ourselves. Yeah, sometimes there was a bit of argy-bargy with some people, but on the whole, we were treated quite well. Of course, there are various incidents that people could say, well, that's not the case. But certainly in the early days, and used to end up in court from time to time. And so little example is, I always conducted myself, I'm a Quaker, and I like to conduct myself with, I suppose, what you might call dignity. It's important to me. And so I was in court one day, and waiting for to come up, and the usher, who knew me by then, came up and he said, "Oh, Fran, I've heard that the bailiffs are just coming up, and I'm going to put your case on next, rather so that you can get it done with, and then you can get back and you can save all your things from the bailiffs." So there were a number of incidents like that, and I left the main camp because at one point what I call the feminist fascists took over, and they thought they could tell me what to do and how to think and not to have any compassion. And I moved off to another gate. I was just on my own in my teepee, and the local police used to come for a cup of tea.
You won, didn't you? Because the cruise missiles didn't actually ever, weren't ever brought in, as I understand it. Or even if they were, it was only for a short time, and the Americans that changed their mind.
Well, yeah, I was there the day they came in, which was deeply upsetting. I mean, I'd left living at the camp, but I turned into a full-time peace campaigner then, because I was the one that designed the non-violence workshops, and me and another woman set up the National Network of Non-Violence Trainers. There have been rumours that those weapons never did arrive. I don't know whether that's true or not.
But did you see them?
Yeah, well, we saw the aeroplanes arrive.
Right. But nothing came off the aeroplanes?
Who knows? I mean, yes. I mean, I think that the rumours saying that they were never there are bunkum. But
actually, there was pressure right across Europe, wasn't there, in the mid-1980s against this? Because countries like Belgium, Germany, France, all were thinking, well, this just makes us a target for Russian ballistic missiles.
Absolutely. We had people flying in from all over the world to be at Greenham. I remember people coming from Australia and New Zealand, and they weren't coming to Europe for a holiday. They came to be at Greenham.
Amazing. At the time, campaign for nuclear disarmament was quite big, wasn't it? I mean, it was stronger and bigger than it is today.
Yes, it was much stronger, much bigger. However, they did not approve of direct action.
Well, they didn't approve of camping outside a base. I mean,
they would not take on. I don't know what the technical term is. Anyway, they wouldn't adopt CND taking direct action. Mm. So, yeah, they supported us. Bruce Kent used to come to visit quite often. He's a lovely chap. Bruce Kent was the head of CND in those days. Yeah, they supported us, but they would not adopt direct action for themselves. But then when I left Greenham, me and my friend Annie Tunnicliffe, we got onto the central organisation of CND and changed that.
So you did a bit of infiltrating yourself.
Well, we got ourselves elected onto the National Council and made sure we got onto the key committee and pushed it through so that CND would adopt direct action. And it was then too that with their backing that Annie and I set up the National Network of Nonviolence Trainers.
What about today? Because the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament of just this autumn just had their national conference here in Bristol.
Yeah, and how sad that was. I mean, it was an interesting place to go and very informative too. I did learn quite a bit, but how sad how few people were there. I mean, back in the 80s, the conference used to be, you know, great big cinema size hall, you know, of people. And now it was just, you know, a little lecture theatre at the top of the Wills building.
But isn't that just a sign of the times? I think, you know, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s as well, maybe, the whole idea of the nuclear deterrent was something quite new. Now it's, you know, hasn't everyone got a nuclear deterrent? Almost everyone?
I think the thing is that back in the 70s and 80s, it was very real. The Cold War was very real. You did think that you were going to be blown up any moment. It was much scarier than climate change is now. Now, because that's kind of gone not in the public domain anymore, the threat hasn't gone away. In fact, in some ways it's got worse, particularly with the who's in charge of America. But the fear was so tangible back then. Whereas now, there are so many things. Back then, it was a single issue. It was the only thing people were really concerned about. Now we've got climate change, plastics, I mean, you name it, there's 101 things that we can be campaigning about. Well,
there's also the financial so-called crisis, you know, the bailouts and all that. Apparently the government's not got enough money to do even keep the toilets open
anymore.
That's
right, and Brexit, I mean, God knows what, there's everything, isn't there? There's everything. So, you know, why worry about something like CND? Well, the thing is, you know, when we did Embrace the Base at Greenham, that was because altogether the perimeter fence around was about 12 miles. And we had a demonstration where people linked hands all around 12 miles. Now, how many people was that? You know, I mean, thousands and thousands. And my point is, if everybody who ever visited Greenham, who was on the Embrace the Base, if every single one of those joined CND, they wouldn't necessarily have to do anything or fill their brains with more information that we're all getting flooded with, but just their membership money could help the people in central CND launch a campaign that could make people more aware of the issues.
Surely it works the other way around. It's when the campaigners say, we're doing this, the membership, you know, the public will join and come alongside them. Unless they're actually, people need to be inspired by a campaign in order to put themselves behind it, surely.
That's a very good point, Tony. That's a very good point. And then because at Greenham, we managed a campaign with no money, with no technology. But there was only one single issue that anybody is worried about. Nowadays, they've got no money to launch a campaign amongst a multitude of issues.
Go straight to hell, boy.
we're now in a situation where Donald Trump has just pulled out of the Intermediate Nuclear Weapons Treaty, which was in force, probably, I imagine it was the 1980s, that would have been put into force because there were threats to put these medium-range nuclear weapons into Europe, and this was a treaty to stop that. You know, this was a bit like the Cuban Missile Crisis. We didn't want them putting their weapons next to our borders and vice versa. But Trump has now pulled out of this treaty. We've also had announced last year Putin saying he's now got nuclear-powered cruise missiles, which are nuclear warheads on them, which can go anywhere in the world. So in a way, we're closer to a potential confrontation. We've also got all the tension in the Middle East with Israel being having nuclear weapons, although they don't like to admit it. And a few weeks ago, we had Netanyahu at Dimona, their nuclear plant, threatening to use weapons against Iran. So how come we're in many ways a more dangerous state today, and yet there doesn't seem to be many people talking about the potential of nuclear war?
How right you are, Tony. It really is actually far more dangerous. The world is very unstable at the moment on so many fronts. And again, I know I'm just kind of getting a bit repeating myself here, but if CND had some more membership money, they could put some banners up on buses, they could do some hoardings, they could get some professional people running projects on the internet. But it takes money to inform people, and the easiest thing is just to join CND. The cheapest ones, you can just pay £3. Just imagine all those thousands and thousands of people that ever visited Greenham chucking in £3 or a donation. We could inform people of how dangerous and unstable the world is right now.
I mean, the CND in a way was set up with the fingers crossed behind the back, wasn't it? Because the British military and the Ministry of Defence are never going to give up Britain's nuclear weapons?
Well, now I've got rather a long story on this one. As a result of being at Greenham, various connections, you know, I made various connections, and I was on the Oxford Research Group, and I ended up having meetings with people like the head of the MOD and very senior military. And one time I was at Chatham House at a meeting of Britain's senior military, of all the various forces, and there were only two women there. And I was very smartly dressed, I must say. And at the end of a talk, this military man came up to me and said, "Excuse me, madam, I'm wondering who you are and what you're doing here." And I looked him fair and square in the eyes and told him that Greenham women are everywhere. And we had some really good conversations, and I talked about strategy and tactics and establishing non-violence. And he said, "Well, I must say, we did find you very difficult to deal with. But actually, that wasn't the point I should have made in answering your question. In answering your question about the military and the MOD not changing their minds, when I had a meeting with a very senior MOD person whose name I never remember, I entered into a dialogue. Now, a dialogue is actually a very frightening thing to do because it's where you really deeply listen to somebody else. And when you deeply listen, something quite odd happens. They speak more candidly, and then they want to hear you. And when you have a dialogue, a genuine dialogue, you cut out your own thought processes. It's almost like being in a meditative state, that you're not thinking about what you're going to say back all the time. So I said my piece, and the consequence of that was I realised, previously I thought he was a warmonger and had nothing but negative thoughts about him. And I'm sure he just thought I was a crackpot.
Well, I suppose if you're someone who'd been at Greenham in the cold and the wet, you were thinking of him as the enemy, really.
Yes. because, as I said, my argument was with the government and he represents the government. So I came away from that meeting realising that he too wanted world peace, but he had a different concept of how to bring it about. And I respected him and I liked him, and I know that was mutual. So, yeah, they're not necessarily going to change their minds overnight. But I think that possibly given the economic situation of our country, you find that every time a senior military person is retired, they start saying that nuclear weapons are a waste of money, but they don't say it when they're in post. So I think given our economic situation, and if by any chance Jeremy Corbyn should become Prime Minister, I think we'd be in with a bit of a chance at least not to have Trident, which is which are the nuclear weapons on submarines based up in Scotland. And so, yeah, the military and the government aren't going to change their minds overnight, but it doesn't mean to say that change isn't possible.
The American military during the Cuban Missile Crisis were almost the opposite to the sort of person you've been describing. I mean, some of them actually actively wanted to start a war because they believed that they could win it, because the Soviet Union were building weapons and they were catching up with the number that the Americans had. And their rather twisted logic was, well, if we have a nuclear war now, we can beat the Soviet Union. So, I mean, do you ever come across people like that who have that attitude that you can win a nuclear war? Have you ever come across anyone that thinks they can?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't come across people like that, because I think you just show them a little bit of the science and what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you can't win a nuclear war. And I haven't met anybody that stupid.
What about the Russians now? Because there's a lot of tension with them, what with this alleged poisoning down in Salisbury and the expulsion of a lot of Russians now. It does seem that almost every month something else happens, which is more and more tension with Russia. It's not the first time that Britain's had tension with Russia. I mean, even the Europeans in the Napoleonic times, and, obviously Hitler's Nazi Germany, tension with Russia then. What about the future with the Russians? Because it does seem like almost one of those key relationships. If the Brits and the Russians can get on, then maybe there is a chance for peace to break out. We were promised, weren't we? You know, after the Cold War, there would be a peace dividend.
Well, this is a big question. Right. So back in the 80s, people kept saying to us, go and tell it to the Russians. So we did. So in 1984, I went to the Soviet Union. I had meetings with the Peace Committee. I also had meetings with dissidents, and we were actually keeping them out of labour camp. So I have had some experience in Russia. And oddly enough, it does seem that a couple of academics say that our visit did play a small part in ending the Cold War, which, I don't know, I can take that with a bit of pinch of salt, but it was still worth doing. So we did go and tell it to the Russians. With the current situation, I do need to do a bit more research, because my understanding is that when the Iron Curtain fell, we made agreements about not putting NATO forces in certain places.
Well, like in East Germany, for example. Yeah. I remember that one too.
And actually, what has happened is we've got NATO bases that completely surround Russia. And also, there's some stuff that I don't know too much about that is to do with satellite wars. And that Star Wars program actually did still go ahead, but we don't hear much about. But I need to inform myself a bit more on that. So, but I know that not only have we got NATO forces completely surrounding Russia, there are also these, I don't know what they're called, but they're special detectors, so that if Russia were to launch anything, they can intercept the anything that Russia launches, which completely destabilizes everything. It means that it does give the NATO forces first strike capability, and that is that it destroys all the balance. Now, I do need to do a bit more research on this, but I believe that that is the case. So my understanding is, I'm no great lover of Putin and what he does to gay people and all sorts of things. No, I don't. However, when you consider he has a country that is surrounded by what is perceived as hostile forces, I think he's taken it all very calmly.
I mean, we've been edging up to the border, haven't we? This is, I mean, this is certainly the way it seems to me. But we'll see what happens. At the end of the day, do you think CND could still be a force in the future?
Well, I think that if they had a bit more money, then they could start doing more public information to... But, you know, the world is so scary at the moment. It's like almost like... It's more negative stuff coming in, isn't it?
Well, look, you've given quite a downbeat review of the conference. Was there anything there that you got something from at the conference that happened here?
Yes. The Lucas Plan and the... Do you remember the Lucas Plan? That was back in the 80s. It was about arms conversion. So manufacturers making arms... The workers at the Lucas plant were looking at what they could make instead.
Oh, this is factories that were making arms, converting to some peaceful
purpose.
Yeah,
but they didn't. But that was, it looked like it might happen back then. So now that is actually being reinvigorated now, is arms conversion. Again, I need to do more research on that. But that was very, very hopeful and, of course, very relevant for Bristol. Because we are quite, we have a lot of employment in the manufacture of arms and weapons. But of course, what people don't realise is that all these places are making an awful lot of redundancies. So people won't lose their jobs if it can be shown that it will be more profitable, like making wind turbines and such like.
This is a one massive problem, isn't it, Fran? I don't know how we deal with this, but actually war is very good for business.
It makes a lot of money.
Any way of stopping that, do you think? Because, I mean, the temptation is to just get involved in any war that happens to be going. For example, Britain is supplying munitions to the Saudi Arabians. Which, as far as I know, is not a democracy. I think it's a dictatorship, basically. And they're bombing Yemen, which is one of the poorest countries in the Middle East, if not the poorest, and destroying UNESCO sites. And we've been told that there's one of the biggest famines and an outbreak of cholera since medieval times taking place in Yemen. So people in Britain are making a lot of money out of this.
Absolutely. And I believe today, I just saw quickly on Facebook, and I didn't read it, Norway and another Scandinavian country, I think, today came out saying they would no longer sell arms to Saudi Arabia. Well, of course, but I'm not talking about selling of arms, I'm talking about the manufacture. So that our people can have different jobs.
You know what? They always come back and they say, look, if we stop, someone else will always do it.
Yeah.
And the Scandinavians have said, well, we're going to stop anyway.
They have, yeah.
We could do the same.
Yeah.
Anyway, Fran Dar, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, Fran Diarth is not the only Fran to have been to Greenham Common. You went there too, Fran Mayer, didn't you?
I did indeed, near to Newbury in Berkshire.
Okay.
Well, I'd seen a lot about it on the television. I thought to myself, I want to join in with this because I was anti-nuclear. I still am. I got arrested once in 1985, just after they'd made trespass on the base, turned it into a criminal offence rather than a civil offence. They couldn't do me for criminal damage because I went through a hole that somebody else had cut in the fence. So they had me criminal trespass. Well, I was going to go to prison, but I thought, no, I'm not going to do that because Mommy Dearest would not like it.
So yeah. This was just literally for going through the fence?
Yeah. And so, oh, and sitting down on the runway. Anyway, with the idea, it was a mass trespass. Hundreds of women had gone in that day. And the idea was for us to get arrested. And we all did.
How many of you?
I don't know how many altogether, but there was in our group there was about 30.
So how long were you there for?
Well, that time, the time I was, the longest I ever spent there was 3 weeks at any one go.
You were sleeping in a tent, I take it?
Yeah, or what they weren't proper benders, okay. The ones that they were just bits of plastic thrown over a rope with big bits of stone on each side.
So you wake up in the morning, what do you do at Greenham Common?
First thing we did is put a brew on. Boiling a kettle over an open fire. And a lot of the women used to go in just about every day to the base. I only did it about 3 or 4 times. I only got caught once. Well, I did it a few times on my own as well. And that was just cutting holes in the fence to annoy the MOD.
Why was it an all-women event? Why do you think?
Well, yes, it was. The men were allowed to visit during the day, but they couldn't stay overnight. And it was, I think it was reverse sexism, I think, basically.
Do you think it was a good idea?
Yes, in retrospect, I think so.
All right, Fran Mayer, thanks very much.
Maya, if you don't mind.
Maya.
Yes.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list if you like, and listen the week before broadcast. That's online at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests. That's Benoit Bennett at stokescroftlandtrust.org, Fran D'Arth from Greenham, and Fran Meyer, also from Greenham. Thanks also to studio engineers Joss Chivers and Dave Bizenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. We're online at prsc.org.uk, or you can talk to PRSC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain, if you've got the time, via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
For once, we agreed.